Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, United States v. Goodwin. Mr. Goodridge.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This is a case where four defendants were among five who went to trial on a federal indictment. The federal indictment charged conspiracy to distribute drugs. It was the culmination of a joint task force investigation spanning from 2003 to 2004. Ultimately, there were 25 counts in the indictment. 21 individuals were indicted. 17, I believe, resolved their cases by plea agreement. Five went to trial. Four were convicted. Those are the four before this Court of Appeals. One client at trial had a hung jury, and he later reached an agreement with the United States and resolved his case by plea. I'll be handling three of the five issues which are in the brief. The first one's the wiretap issue. This was a very sophisticated investigation by the United States of America, and they employed many traditional means of investigation, including the use of confidential informants, the use of surveillance, the use of controlled buys, and also of audio recordings on controlled buys. The affidavit in support of the application for the wiretap, which was eventually endorsed by the district court judge and granted, goes into great detail about the successes of the investigation. And whereas I've been involved in several cases where we've taken different attempts to limit the use of wiretaps, this is kind of the eventual result of some of the prior arguments that I've made. And what the argument is where you have a successful federal investigation that is resulting in cognizable evidence which can be used to convict someone, it appears that in those successful cases where charges could be brought, the government will opt to employ a wiretap to further strengthen their case when they could, you know, just charge the case as it were without the wiretap. So under the
further strengthen, though, means finding, getting closer to the main source, doesn't it?
It can.
Isn't that what this was about?
It can be getting closer to the source, but a traditional method of getting closer to the source would be to indict the individual that you can prove and have him cooperate. The same way that conspiracies are built in federal court without wiretaps.
And that warns everybody that they're looking at him.
That is true, yes. That is correct. But it's the last argument that I had available to me to challenge the wiretap, and that is its utilization.
I have to say it's the first time I've heard it.
You got to get creative. You have Title III cases. But I believe this was a successful investigation, and I think it's very easy for the government to say in many of these investigations that there's always something else, there's always someone else. In getting wiretaps is something that's really becoming more common and I perceive simpler to do for the government. And with their increased use, I'm trying to develop arguments which would curtail it. And here,
well, why? What's the social interest in curtailing these wiretap investigations?
The same interest that makes obtaining wiretaps under Title III so difficult.
That?
Privacy.
But of course, there's more sophistication in wire communications, which we have more and more of. You've got to be ahead of the game, or at least try to keep up with it, it would seem.
And I would agree. And in cases where, you know, there is complex drug conspiracies or other criminal activities where the government can't get into the case, can't penetrate the case, can't develop the use of confidential informants, or, you know, where there's potential 15, 12 issues where witnesses have been threatened or harmed.
Less invasion of privacy if they follow people around and question people and so on. Why would the conventional investigation takes longer? Why does it involve less invasion of privacy?
It would, just for the simple reason that the whole purpose behind Title III is to strictly monitor the government's use.
What's the sense of it? So they follow, they can follow you around everywhere, take pictures of you and all that, question all your acquaintances. So find out this, I mean, your whole point is they can find out all the information in some alternative way. So why isn't the invasion of privacy the same?
I think it's greater.
What's greater about it?
It's in secrecy.
Secrecy when they're following you around and taking, surveillance cameras. That's secret also, right?
Yes, but I would be in a public place.
Great. So, in other words, you protect your privacy by never leaving your house. Is that it?
Someone could choose to do
it. That's ridiculous,
it is,
right? That's
yes.
Absurd.
That is correct.
So this is all some weird shadow boxing. This doesn't have anything to do with reality.
It's theoretical. It's a theoretical argument. That is correct. The second argument goes with regard to drug quantity. Mr. Doar and Mr. Brown, who I'm arguing for today, were both convicted of two counts. Mr. Brown was convicted of count 1 and 17, received 188 months. And then 48 months concurrent. Mr. Doar counts 1 and 6, the same sentence. The jury returned special verdicts with regard to Mr. Doar of 50 grams of cocaine base. The jury returned a verdict with regard to Mr. Brown of 500 grams of cocaine powder form. The government argued at sentencing, and the district court adopted those findings, that they should receive the same sentences as Michael Hardiman and that it was reasonably foreseeable. I think the best evidence with regard to Mr. Doar of his involvement in the conspiracy was the jury's return verdict, which I believe the district court should have considered and employed in both its analysis under the guidelines, which are advisory, and 3553A. That's a more difficult argument, however, for Mr. Brown, because Mr. Brown was a higher-level distributor who was actually distributing drugs from Chicago, Illinois, into the southern Indiana area. For Mr. Doar, he started out as a government snitch and did a couple of controlled buys, and then eventually turned up on the wiretaps. So I think a more reasonable sentence for Mr. Doar would have been 120 months, which would have been the minimum. That's the essence of that argument. The final argument that I'll address briefly is Mr. Doar, because he was working with the government, he was a cooperating witness initially, who ended up being indicted because he turned up on two wiretap phone calls and became a member of the conspiracy, which was the evidence. Wanted to assert a public authority defense, but he was not allowed to do that in front of the district court. But also prior to trial, he filed a motion to sever. And in his motion to sever, he thought he wanted to be able to show himself as a credible person, show himself as someone who was working with the government, with Mr. Smith. And he was concerned that the defenses between everyone would be mutually antagonistic. Ultimately, that did occur at trial, and he was unable to present evidence of the probable cause, the affidavits in support of search warrants which were issued by the government based upon his cooperation, and there were three warrants. So that's the third issue.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Goodridge.
Thank you.
Mr. Groves?
Yes, sir. Good morning. May I please the court? I represent Jermall Phillips. My issue today is regarding the testimony of Special Agent Doug Freiberger, who was the case agent and also was qualified as an expert in trial to interpret the language of the wiretaps as code talk. I could find no conclusive Seventh Circuit precedent, so in the brief we cited to some Second Circuit cases, which I think should be persuasive authority. Both the Dukagini case and the Greenwich case deal with this issue. Dukagini deals with whether or not the case agent qualifies as an expert, whereas Greenwich deals with whether the case agent is a lay witness. I believe in this case at bar, Mr. Freiberger was absolutely qualified as an expert witness, although the term expert was not used. Since he was an expert, his testimony should have been limited, and our motion in limine should have been granted to specific words that were used as code, which represent drugs that he had learned about in his experiences as an agent, not in his involvement in the case. For example, in some of his testimony, he referred to something at least two times as meaning drugs. He referred to them at least two times meaning drugs. He referred to dry, meaning the absence or lack of drugs in a particular area.
What difference does it make whether he testifies as an expert or as a lay witness?
Well, if he testifies...
Can he testify as both?
Well, if he is given the cloak of expertise, then the jury is going to be influenced by his testimony. I see my time has expired.
Well, if he's an expert, he can give an opinion, based on what he's learned in other cases and so on. So he can give an opinion because he's experienced and he's heard these words used in other cases. But if he also listened to them in this case, what's wrong with that?
I think it invades the province of the jury
That's a conclusion. Well, what's wrong with it? Why shouldn't the jury be able to listen to that? How are they going to be misled or
Well, as a lay witness, he would be summarizing the government's theory of the case as fact. Whereas if the jury were to read individual one say, "I need something," in a phone conversation to individual number two, the jury could determine that something could mean anything, not necessarily drugs.
Look, I don't understand.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could he qualify as an expert and talk about these words without reference to the present case?
Yes. For example,
he could also testify about the present case, right? Because he was involved in it. So why can't he testify about both the present case and about his general experience? What's the abuse?
Well, I think it allows the jury or gives the jury...
Look, you could have an expert and you could have a direct witness, lay witness or something. Well, why can't you have them both in one person?
I think it crosses a line where it creates some confusion for the jury with regard to which portion of his testimony should be given credibility regarding his expertise.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Groves. Mr. Gramp?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court. My name is Glenn Gramp. I represented Mr. Goodwin at trial and on his behalf moved to incorporate argument of counsel in this argument today on his behalf as it is appropriate. The one issue that I'm going to present deals with the trial court's failure to grant a new trial. I think the government and the appellants all agree as to what the law is and that a new trial should have been ordered if the defendant or appellant here could demonstrate that the prosecution's case included perjured testimony, that the prosecution knew or should have known about the perjury, and that there was a likelihood that but for the false testimony, the outcome of the case would have been different. In this case, as it applies to Mr. Goodwin, the government listed the assistance of an informant by the name of Seneca Binder. And it's our position that Mr. Binder perjured himself. We addressed that issue during the course of the trial through extensive cross-examination of Mr. Binder, as well as his handler, Evansville Police Officer Cliff Simpson. We also believe that his perjury, or the fact that he lied, is demonstrated by his affidavit that was tendered in support of the motion for new trial, where during the course of the hearing, in the affidavit, he recanted his testimony at trial, and then at the hearing on the motion for new trial, he recanted what he said in the affidavit and indicated that someone else wrote it for him. He signed it, denied that he signed it in front of notaries, and I believe that that was later established that it had been notarized. But in any event, we believe that the testimony of Mr. Binder was, in fact, perjured testimony, and we believe that we met the first test of the requirement. The second deals with whether or not the government knew or should have known that Mr. Binder would lie. We believe that that's established by the testimony in this case, in as much as he repeatedly was used as an informant, repeatedly committed more crimes, and testified that he was a dishonest individual, testified that he had lied to the police officers.
He recanted his statement that was submitted by saying he was forced to sign it, right?
He recanted that. He continued to recant. That is correct. And I appreciate the problem. And I think that the government didn't exactly address it the way we addressed it in our brief. In our brief, we were contending that by virtue of his lying, that we were entitled to a new trial. We believe that his testimony was suspect for the reasons that I've said. We believe that the outcome, at least as far as Mr. Goodwin, would have been different. If the court will look at the indictment, the alleged misconduct began in the indictment in July of 2003 through June of 2004. Mr. Binder brought Mr. Goodwin into this indictment in February. The eight substantive counts were directly attributable to Mr. Binder, where he purportedly identified Mr. Goodwin. This was described as a crack house during the course of the trial. The testimony was that a number of individuals went into and out of this house. It was not used entirely for the purpose of drugs or any other legal activity. On some of the wiretaps, there was basketball games being listened to. There were a number of people going in and out. And not all of those people were charged, and not all of those people were involved in illicit activity. Mr. Binder implicated Mr. Goodwin in return for his brother, Mr. Binder's brother, being not charged for other criminal activity. Mr. Binder implicated Mr. Goodwin in the four substantive counts, as in counts 5, 6, 7, and 9. He identified his voice on tape, and we believe there was no other basis for that. We also believe that he pointed out Mr. Goodwin to the investigating officers when they didn't have any other evidence to implicate him in this particular conspiracy. We also believe that his involvement in identifying the voice and identifying photographs were instrumental in Mr. Goodwin's convictions and substantive counts 11, 12, 13, and 15. And obviously, all eight of those are implicated in the conspiracy. So we believe that Mr. Binder's testimony was perjured testimony. We also believe that the government should have known based on the prior dealings with him and his own admissions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Graham. Mr. Brookman?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of Indiana. I was the trial counsel for the government on this case, and I'm here today asking this court to affirm the convictions and the sentences that were given to Mr. Goodwin, Mr. Brown, Mr. Phillips, and Mr. Doerr. I'll try to take them in the order that that appellant's counsel addressed the issues, and start with the necessity issue on the wiretap. The appellants contend that the informants alone could have done the job in this case and that they would have been able to satisfy every aspect of the investigation, but the district court correctly recognized that this wasn't the case. Right off the bat, as the court already noted, The informants had no information about the Chicago area sources for the drugs. Neither Mr. Binder or Mr. Doerr, who were the informants in the wiretap affidavit, knew Leo Brown, one of the Chicago sources. They didn't know Vishnu Bender, another one of the Chicago sources. Throughout the investigation, they never mentioned these people, never had any idea where the drugs were coming from, other than generally possibly coming from Chicago. Could not identify anybody at that level. And as this court correctly noted, the object of an investigation like this is to try to get to the source of the drugs, which is almost always outside of Evansville and frequently here in Chicago. So they were the informants were limited in this respect. Similarly, they were limited in knowing when the drugs were coming from Chicago, regardless of who they were coming from, even intercepting packages when they came from Chicago to Evansville. And there, an example of this was put in the second affidavit for the second 30 days. Over wiretap conversations, the government learned on a couple of occasions that there were cars coming from Chicago to Evansville bringing cocaine. The informants obviously were not made aware of the wiretap investigation. They were continue to be debriefed, though, as they could be, and neither of them ever mentioned any of these packages that were coming from Chicago to Evansville. So the wiretap evidence itself demonstrated the limitations of the informant's ability to further the investigation. They were similarly at the other end of the chain. They were unaware of many of the other distributors who were in the Evansville area. They were unaware of the stash locations other than the locations that they had particularly personally dealt with, the house on Baird Park or the house on Belmead or Washington Avenue that Michael Hardiman and Victor Goodwin had used. Beyond those locations, they were unaware of other stash house locations in the Evansville area where the cocaine was brought when it came from Chicago. Again, the wiretap investigation revealed that there were several other stash locations, and in particular another house just down the street from Victor Goodwin's house on Baird Park. Neither of the informants ever identified this location or were apparently aware of that location. Now, the law enforcement officers also involved in the case, and the affiant in particular, also addressed in the affidavit the idea of going out and cultivating more informants, and they discounted this as a likely way of furthering the investigation beyond the targets that the original informants had identified. The original informants were not trusted by the organization. There was no reason to believe that any new informants would be trusted if any new informants could be cultivated. On one occasion, Seneca Binder was patted down during a transaction with Victor Goodwin and several of his associates. There was nothing led the police officers to believe that other informants would be able to get any farther with the organization than Binder or Doerr had gotten. So, I think in this instance, probably necessary to defer to the law enforcement officer's judgment on this because they're the ones on the street, they're the ones that know the investigation and know what informants are potentially out there and what they might be able to do. So I think the district court correctly recognized that informants alone were not going to satisfy the full aspect of the investigation and that a wiretap was necessary, and asked this court to affirm the district court's decision in this respect. With respect to the issue of the drug weight, the appellants, as I understand it, contend that the district court should have simply accepted the jury's findings for drug weight. The jury was asked to find drug weights in this case before statutory sentencing purposes. I don't, to this day, after the verdict came back, quite understand how the jury got to the amounts that they did, but I respect their decision on that, and that's the decision they made. But the district court, as opposed to the jury, had much more information that it was aware of that the jury was never made aware of. And the district court, under the statute, is allowed to consider all sorts of information, not just what the jury has determined as far as drug weight. The district court had the benefit of hearing Michael Hardiman's guilty plea, hearing what he had to say about his involvement with the organization. Michael Hardiman was receiving his cocaine and cocaine base from Leo Brown. He was distributing to Timothy Doerr. His amounts were certainly reasonably foreseeable to both of them. He pled, of course, to a level 36, which is exactly what these two defendants were assessed at their sentencing. Brown, Leo Brown had phone calls with Michael Hardiman where they talked about kilogram quantities of cocaine, talked about turning that cocaine into cocaine base. So the evidence that the court had was more than what the jury had. And, of course, the court was allowed to consider all the evidence that it had before it, and it correctly considered the drug weight based on all of that evidence. With respect to the motion for the severance by Timothy Doerr, the motion, when it was presented to the district court, was kind of a twofold thing. It was a notice of a public authority defense, and it was a motion to sever based on that notice of public authority defense. The notice of public authority defense was ultimately denied, and the defendant wasn't allowed an instruction or allowed to go forward with a public authority defense. And the reason for that was essentially he wasn't claiming that the activities that he was charged with were done at the request of the police. He was claiming that he had done some activities with the police earlier and that he was doing further activities because he thought they might like him to do that, even though he had not been directed to do that by the police, and also that he had never intended, his defense also at trial was that he never intended to consummate the things that he was talking about on the phone. The jury obviously did not believe that defense. But when the district court denied his public authority defense, his need for a severance essentially vanished. The appellants, Mr. Doerr, doesn't challenge on appeal that the court correctly denied his public authority defense. Without that, there really is no basis for a severance in this case. Mr. Doerr points to the fact that the district court disallowed his offer of a search warrant affidavit to be put into evidence at trial. However, the search warrant, whether or not Mr. Doerr had been tried by himself or with his co-defendants, the search warrant affidavit was rank hearsay. It contained all sorts of hearsay beyond what Mr. Doerr had provided. It wouldn't have been admissible at any trial, and it really didn't prejudice Mr. Doerr that he could not get that search warrant affidavit into evidence, because Mr. Doerr's counsel was allowed to question Ethan Smith, one of the law enforcement officers who worked with Mr. Doerr and who was the affiant on the search warrant, about the fact that Tim Doerr had provided information that he had been deemed reliable, all the things that defense counsel wanted to get out through the admission of the search warrant affidavit itself. So essentially, there was no issue with regard to a need for a severance in this case. He had no substantial trial right, which was prejudiced because of it. And lastly, Your Honors, I'll address the motion for new trial. The district court correctly concluded that Defendant Goodwin didn't meet any of the requirements for the new trial. First off, the court found that Mr. Binder had not testified falsely or that there had not been perjury committed. The district court, of course, had the benefit of sitting at the trial and watching observing Mr. Binder's testimony at trial, and then also observing his testimony at the motion for new trial. Binder acknowledged that the document, the purported recanting document, contained his signature, but he was told that he was unaware of what the document said, that he was told to sign it, not by Victor Goodwin, but by an intermediary, presumably. He felt threatened to sign it. There were some statements made about his family and whatnot that he felt threatened to sign the document. Most importantly, at the motion for new trial, he reaffirmed that everything he had testified to at trial was true and that he was not recanting his testimony from trial.
So this document was found between the trial or after the trial? Is that
yes, sir.
Came up?
This document came up. It was produced in a motion for new trial is the first time I saw it. It was attached to the motion for new trial. It was apparently notarized by a jailer. It had a heading, Statement of CI 1156 or whatever. It didn't even name Mr. Binder by name, but it did have Mr. Binder's signature on the bottom, and because of that, the court ordered a hearing on the motion. But at that hearing, as I indicated, there was all of the evidence showed that it was a fraud, that it was coerced, probably, in my opinion, and I argued for it, that
coerced
Mr.
by whom?
I think it was coerced by Mr. Goodwin, and I argued that he should have gotten two more levels for doing that post-trial. The court didn't give him that, but nonetheless.
This was while he was in prison?
Mr. Goodwin was, everyone was in the Vanderbilt.
So they were all?
Still in federal custody awaiting sentencing.
So they were all able to, I guess, communicate with each other?
Well, they were separated, but I'm sure this court's aware that you can, if you want to, you can get a you know, through an intermediary or whatever, you can get word to somebody else if you need to in most jails, if not most prisons.
Including the affidavit form and somebody to notarize.
Exactly. But under the standard, you know, that there was a clear and manifest abuse of judicial discretion, there's simply no way that this court did anything but the right thing in denying the motion for new trial. I see my time's up. If there aren't any other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the convictions
in
this case.
Thank you, Mr. Rookman. So, would any of you like a minute to respond? Or?
Not on behalf of Mr. Dillashaw.
No? Okay, well, were you appointed, all of you?
Oh, all of them were.
Yes, I'm private on appeal, but hearing for Mr. Brown.
Right. Okay, well, we thank the three of you for accepting the appointments. And thank you to Mr. Brookman also.